Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Listeners, welcome back. We have Dr. Amy Boddy today, which is so exciting. Currently, she's actually my professor, but she is also an associate professor at UC Santa Barbara, killing it, doing awesome work in the biological anthropology side of things, specifically working within, so many things, but comparative oncology, using evolutionary approaches to biology, maternal fetal conflict, all kinds of things that we're going to dive into today. But welcome to the podcast, Dr. Boddy. I'm so thankful that you're here.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to chat to you today about all these interesting topics.
Yes. I'm so excited to kind of like learn. Personally, I feel like your approach to anthropology is very different than anyone I've talked to, which I feel like is really good because, you know, I've had a lot of people on the podcast. And so I'm always thankful that I get to learn different ways to look at things. So just to start, I'm really interested, like, how did you even get started on this path? Were you always a science girl? You know, what drew you into biology and specifically medicine? Because your PhD is from a, you know, school in medicine. So that's a really strong component of your training.
Yeah. I get asked that a lot. I guess I am. So I guess it means I am a little different if I keep getting asked this question. But it's interesting. I've been reflecting on this now that, you know, I'm, you know, a professor and teaching undergrads. I reflect on like my journey as an undergrad as well. And I was so clueless. Like I mean, I started out at a community college. In Michigan, I was in Metro Detroit area, and I did community college for quite a few years, just sampling classes. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I'm a first generation, so I was a little nervous to even go to a full four-year university. But then I took this biology class, and like, I mean, it was a community college. This professor was amazing. He was just so excited to come in and teach biology, and I just fell in love with it. And so I ended up enrolling in a four-year university at Wayne State University in biology. And at that time, I was, I think in my, I don't know, I always say senior year, but I didn't do a traditional like four-year university because I was a transfer student and credits didn't transfer and all this stuff. So I ended up doing my undergrad in like 5 years. But I will say my senior year, I took an anthropology class. And then I was like, I remember coming home and telling my partner, I think I want to switch my major to anthropology. And he was like, you're about to graduate. Don't switch your major. Again, clueless. I was clueless. Yeah. And I was like, right. Okay. Yeah, you're right. and then after that, I decided again, it's like pretty naively, I didn't know what I wanted to do next. So I applied to grad school. I got into the school of medicine there in their grad program, but still in the back of my mind. So I started studying actually like super like molecular based things. Like I was studying the genetics of aortic aneurysms, and it just didn't hit my interest as much as evolutionary biology, anthropology. I was studying human health. I went to this school because I was like, I'm so interested in studying human health. But the, like the evolutionary part wasn't there and it wasn't fulfilling. So I actually switched labs in grad school. And I, ended up in a lab, who the PI was actually an anthropologist. who's formerly trained as an anthropologist and is now in the School of Medicine, talking about the evolution of the placenta and evolution of preeclampsia and all these really neat intersections between human health and evolution. And so we were the odd lab out because we had evolutionary approaches in the med school. But I think it was really foundational for my training. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't realize that you did your undergrad at Wayne State too. So you just spent so much time in Michigan. Michigan is one of the most beautiful places. Do you still like love it?
Yeah, I love it. I love going up north. There's just so much. So many trees, especially, I mean, after Michigan, we moved to like Phoenix and I was like, and we went camping for the first time. And I'm like, what?
You're like, this is like camping. It's my backyard.
I know. I feel so exposed here. You just feel exposed where Michigan is like soft and there's trees and it's just, there's no bugs that are trying to kill you. I love Michigan. I stayed and that was something like, to those of you that are inspiring to go on to grad school, it was always recommended that you switch undergrad and grad programs, right? Mm-hmm. It's not necessary. I do think it's good to reach out. I didn't even know that. I didn't even know I was doing the faux pas there, but I think I just was, you know, my family was in Michigan. We weren't ready to move yet. And I stayed put. And I think
sometimes it's a good,
it worked
life,
out well. Yeah.
Life decision. Even like someone who I'm going to be talking to later, like Hannah Frog did her undergrad and now grad at UCSB. Sometimes it just works out for people.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be a negative. It could be a very good positive because you have like good connections, a good training program. You can like have some, you know, continuing themes if you, especially if you did research as an undergrad. So,
Now the next question I have, I feel like you're going to laugh, is with the Detroit, Michigan connection, do you know Dax Shepard?
Oh, I don't. I don't know him.
Dang it.
I do. Wait, though. We could do like the 6 degrees if you want. I think I know an anthropologist. We invited her out here and then she went to school or her husband went to school and they know him. So
yeah. Cause he went to UCLA. So he knows like Jason DeLeon and people like that. That's who it is. Yeah. Jason. Yeah. It was so funny. Someone recommended that I have Jason on my podcast and I was like, literally he's been on Armchair Expert and about 20 other podcasts. Like there's no way I'm even trying.
Oh, you should try. You could try. I bet you'd get him.
Anyway, so Dax Shepard's podcast is the main reason that I wanted to start my podcast. I just absolutely love the way that he asks questions and I love that it's like a very conversation based, like human, who are the humans behind, you know, these cool people. So anyway, I just thought, I was like, maybe Amy, maybe she knows Dax. But moving back to kind of your journey, your first appointment after grad school was at UCSF, right? Which is University of California, San Francisco, for people that aren't aware, within the Department of Surgery. So what was that transition like? All of a sudden, you're now a professor. I feel like it's such a crazy thing to go from a grad student to a professor.
Well, I was a postdoc. That was position. Yeah. And so after grad school, I went to do a postdoc. Yeah, Department of Surgery. I've been in so many different departments. I've been in the Department of Surgery. I've been in, you know, a genetics department. I've been in a psychology department, and now I'm in an anthropology department. So don't let any department define you.
I think that's a good tip.
You can be interdisciplinary, but it is hard to be interdisciplinary because sometimes people ask questions like, you don't fit and you have to justify why you do. And sometimes you don't need that justification. We know diverse perspectives are really important. But that transition to UCSF, I mean, Detroit is a much different city than San Francisco. It was just like, I had this dream. Like, I was like, oh, I got this really awesome job at UCSF. Like moving at that time, I had a one-year-old. Moving my whole family across the country. I'm so excited. I know we couldn't afford to live in the city, so we lived in the Bay Area. And I just thought, like, I know it's an hour commute, but I'll bring some papers and I'll drink some coffee and I'll just sit on the train and like read, you know, mm-hmm. before work. And the first day, like, I got to the BART station and the train opens and people are like shoving themselves yeah. in. And I'm like holding my coffee and I'm like, oh, like, I never sat that whole commute. Like, I was just squished and it was just such a like naive perspective to have. And then
that's. You're like, it'll be a nice leisure commute.
Yeah, just leisure. And then it's like people shoving themselves in. My coffee spilled. Yeah. It was just that was an interesting time. And then we were only there for a few months and then we took off and I spent a year in Berlin. Wow. At the time my postdoc advisors, Athena Actipus and Carlo Maley, went on sabbatical to this institute in Berlin. So I kind of tagged along with them.
And how was that with a little baby?
It was great. She was, I mean, we enrolled her in a German daycare and I was taking German classes, but I'm not very good at picking up language. And so I was doing the best I could. And she would come home and she was immersed in the German language. And I had no idea what she was saying. It's like a little 2-year-old. And I was like, oh, she was like mashing it together, like German and English. And
that's adorable.
It was really great. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that it was a good experience with her and not some horrible, stressful thing.
No, I mean, like there was stress, but I don't know. I look back at those times and it was, I'm really glad we did that. Yeah.
Yeah, I am too. So then in 2000, well, actually, I'm not sure what year it was. You go to ASU.
Yep.
And that's what we were talking about, living in the desert. I've started to realize I need to deconstruct these acronyms for like non-US people. So Arizona State University in the middle of the desert.
Middle of the desert.
Yes. And you actually still work with that team on comparative oncology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what was your main role there and like your continuing role going forward?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting. So For my PhD, I was doing a more comparative perspective on brain size across a bunch of different mammals. And I used like a life history approach and all this stuff. And then when this job posting announcement came out, it seemed so perfect because it was like, we want to study life history in cancer. And I was like, what? Those are like two things I'm super interested in. Even though I wasn't studying cancer at the time, I had rotated in a lab early on in my grad career and did some cancer research. And I was like, oh, this is like merging two really cool interests. And we didn't really know a lot about cancer and other species during that time. And so it was super fun to just start exploring that and applying life history and evolution to cancer biology. Like, so it'd been recognized for a while that cancer evolves, right? And it could operate under these evolutionary principles within the human host, or as we'll see, any multicellular host. But it didn't really catch on. And so it was really interesting, again, looking back on my postdoc, I just came in with that assumption that we all were on the same page with evolution in cancer and went to this big AACR meeting and no one was talking about like the evolutionary dynamics. Now they are. And the field has really taken off, but it was really interesting to come in on that so early on and start building on that. Yeah.
And I mean, you continue to work on it. So it's really been something that's kind of traversed your career. And I'm sure it's something that you want to continue building. I mean, I think being able to be at the forefront of research is really cool because you're asking the questions that you're genuinely interested in that no one's asked before. And how has that been for you? Are you just constantly learning as you go and just using new methods to test your questions, I imagine?
Yeah, I like it's such a fun like it keeps you up at night because there's so mm-hmm. many questions. Like it's like when the results come in, you're not satisfied. You're like, wait, mm-hmm. what? Like now I have even more questions to mm-hmm. ask, you know? And so it's really exciting about that. And then, yeah, learning new methods, but also just getting more collaborations. Yeah. And so that's what I find is the funnest part of the job. But also like the most critical is like, okay, now we're kind of studying the ecology of cancer biology, and we need to like recruit ecologists to the team, and just getting, pulling methods from different fields means pulling individuals in and teaching them about cancer biology. And yeah. that's kind of like an exciting area. Yeah.
How do you normally go about finding the right person to bring into a project within those constraints that you were talking about?
Yeah, usually, I mean, it's been on pause since COVID, but we started this conference series, International Society for Ecology, Evolution, and Cancer. We just invite people to come talk. Cool. Like you're an ecologist. We had an aunt ecologist, Deborah Gordon, and it was so relatable to cancer. Like just thinking about movement and ants, and you're like, that doesn't sound like it relates to cancer at all, but I swear it does. There's certain principles that still apply, and just pulling them in and getting them excited about their work and how it could be translatable to cancer biology. So, yeah,
that's cool. Are you at a standing desk?
I am.
Oh my gosh. Is that how do you take all your meetings like that?
I try and stand up for meetings. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. Just this year, my back started being pretty cranky. Sitting for 8 hours a day isn't good.
Yeah. The human body is fickle.
Yeah. I almost wanted to get, I have a colleague who has like a bike.
Oh.
Like a bike seat. It's almost like a stationary bike without the handlebar.
Uh-huh. And then so you could still like move your arms.
Yeah. And then it's like a bike desk.
Yeah. And it's like core because you're like holding yourself up.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now you're at UCSB. Mm-hmm. And I mean, talk about transition. Detroit, San Francisco, Arizona, UCSB. You really got like the dichotomy of, yeah. I mean, not of all the US, but those are some very different environments.
Yes.
I mean, I know, like, so I'm going to be starting grad school at George Mason, and I'm really looking forward to kind of the East Coast pace of things, because like mm-hmm. things here in Santa Barbara, it is a different pace of life, and it's not bad. Oh, it's just a different pace of life. So how was that transition for you?
It's funny that you mentioned pace, because I just actually met up with a colleague that I knew in Detroit. She was actually on one of my grad cohorts committees, and she got here and she's like, give me advice. And I'm like, the pace is different here. It's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, just slow down. Like you just gotta, especially coming from ASU, like Arizona State University is booming right now. So when I showed up there, they had just opened the Center for Evolutionary Medicine as well, which is a really exciting time. It was, I think, one of the first centers for evolutionary medicine that popped up in the US. And so there's all these people coming in, there's speakers every day. Like, it's just like this, I mean, there's, I think 70,000 students at ASU. Yeah. So it's just like this huge, massive thing. And it was like, you were on, you had to like, mm-hmm. you know, it was just a lot. It was exciting, but, and then you come here and everything's just much slower, you know, it's just, you got to take time. And I
gotta
actually,
go to the beach.
You got to go to the beach. The weather's nice. Let's go outside. Let's take a walk, mm-hmm. a walking meeting around the lagoon. So I really love it here. But the pace is so different. I don't think I could go back to speeding up again either. Like, it's just not, I can't believe I used to be able to be productive in such a environment, but you figure it out, right? You adapt to your environment. Mm-hmm.
I think the thing I'm looking forward to most is no longer being on the quarter system.
Yeah. Right now. I mean, we're talking about it. It's May. We still got 3 weeks of classes.
Yep.
all my colleagues, ASU, they're off for the summer.
Yep. Yep. I think by the time you get to quarter three, there is just no more juice to recharge.
I know.
The body. My coworkers and I were just talking about that, how we're all just exhausted. And I was like, yeah, I'm looking forward to the semester system. I will say the one plus about the quarter system, and that I'm super thankful about, especially given like how many great classes there are at UCSB, is I got to take like double the amount of classes that a lot of like my friends got to take. And I'm really thankful for that. But as a senior who's now been doing it for 4 years and 2 years of pandemic, I'm ready for some change.
I agree. My undergrad and grad were all on the semester system, and coming to the quarter system, everyone, from the professor point of view, you actually teach less. It's like 2 weeks less, and everyone's like, oh, it's better you teach less. But there's like no time to really go into depth about anything in class. Like, and for you too, like you're 10 weeks, you like, boom, boom, you gotta learn everything. Like even this class, you had to learn genetics in a week. Right. Yeah. Like, and it's like, and then that's it. We're moving on because we can't spend any more time because there's only 10 weeks to get it all in. And I kind of wish there was more time to like, because by the time like week seven rolls around, everyone's like on the same page and you know the class dynamics and the personalities. And I'm like, I don't want this to end. I don't want a new cohort. I want to keep going with this cohort. We're finally like in the groove of things. And then, then it's finals.
Speaking of, I love our evolutionary medicine class. I feel like every day I go, everyone always has like really good insights. And it's a class where every time someone asks a question, it's like a really interesting question that always like piques like a new question and thought. It's so cool.
Thank you. It's one of my favorite classes to teach. And I'd be interested to hear, because I used to teach it and it was smaller. It was 45 students. And we were able to have a lot more conversation, but it's such a popular topic that I wanted to broaden it. And so now it's 100 students. And so it's a lot more lecture based, but I really try and still engage.
I'm surprised to hear that it used to be smaller just because of the way it is. It definitely seems like it fits for a bigger class. And I think you've definitely like built in things to engage. That's a class that I would be happy to have a section in, you know. There are other classes I feel like have a section that don't need it, and like that one I would actually be excited to have a section for. But also it's so hard for people to fit sections into their schedules, I feel like.
That class is just a whirlwind because I want to teach everyone genetics and immunology. You have 10 weeks. It's like genetics, immunology, and then I just touch on diseases, like each disease, but you only have like a lecture for each disease. So I could see how like a section to actually like learn more about what you just did. I've thought about making it just a big intro class and then it would have sections. But really it's just to get people excited about evolutionary perspective to like their own body. And so part of it's just like, here are all the cool topics you can think about. Like, and now go explore it. Right.
Maybe down the road. And I don't know like what your like long-term plans are teaching wise, but maybe even making it like an AB class, you know, like as in like there's a class A, cause I've taken, like I took osteology at UCSB as AB. And I feel like that was actually really helpful to take them back semesters, like back to back and have a continuation. An idea.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Yeah. I know that you have honestly like a really big lab on campus in that you work with undergrads as well. And in my mind, like if you have undergrads, grad students, and postdocs, like that's kind of like a really like booming lab on our campus. How do you kind of work within your lab group and foster mentorship, whether it's with the grad students and undergrads or mentorship between you and the students? What's kind of the dynamic of working within your lab?
Good question. It's forever changing depending on the students, right? And the projects. We're just getting started with a project on microchimerism, which is you'll learn about it in, I think, next week in EdMed, that it's the transfer of cells between the mother and baby. Well, microchimerism is a small amount of cells that are not your own, harbored within your body, and this happens naturally during pregnancy. Fetal cells migrate to the mother and maternal cells migrate to the fetus. And so we have this really great resource where we get samples from Cottage Hospital, and then we can look for microchimerism in the maternal blood.
That's great.
And so I have a few undergrads working on that, and it's really great. Like, when we think about mentorship, is so my postdoc, who was like the only other person in the country that got a PhD in microchimerism. I was so excited to find her. Her name's Dr. Tiffany Pan, and she's amazing. And you should probably have her on the podcast.
Yes.
But she actually did her PhD in microchimerism, studying maternal microchimerism in adult offspring. And so anyway, she is clutch in being able to train people in the lab. She's the one that does it all, but it's really empowering because now I have a sophomore who is training other students in the lab. So we have a lot of peer-to-peer training happening.
That's really
and
exciting.
I'm super excited because it's just like she's picked up the technique so well, and now she's able to train her peers. And I hope to, now that we have that system in place, I could see how it could continuously produce some peer-to-peer mentorship, and I'm really excited about that. And we meet like once a week to just talk over what they're doing in the lab and look at data analysis. So yeah,
awesome. It's pretty great. One of my friends is in your lab, Nikki.
Oh yeah,
yes.
Nikki's wonderful.
I love Nikki.
And I'll just, they're amazing. They just went to a conference this past weekend and they won.
Yeah, I was just about to ask. Wow.
And it was, you know, they're undergrads and they were competing against grad students and all that. So they did wonderful.
Incredible. I was going to ask how the conference went, because you guys camped.
Yeah, we camped. Well, I didn't. We camped, but a few of us had an RV.
Hey, that's still a version of camping.
Yeah. So. But it was really great. I love this conference. It's been virtual for 2 years. It's called CWES. It's just a bunch of, I guess it's been running for like 20 years. And it's just linking the California schools together. And it's, you know, evolutionary approaches
awesome.
To social sciences. So there's a lot of psychologists, anthropologists that come, evolutionary medicine folks. And it's broadened. Like there's people from ASU coming now, and it's really great. But it's a conference for students, run by students, and it's one of my favorite conferences.
Yeah. I think conferences that are more intimate like that aren't just like a whole like talking about like AABAs or something, you know, sometimes it can be so overwhelming, especially for your first or second one as an undergrad. It's so much better to be able to get your feet wet in a really like down to earth environment like that, where you can actually talk to not all, but a good chunk of the people there.
Right. And I mean, it's just such an accessible conference. I had an undergrad that was like, she wasn't presenting, but she was like, can I still go? And I'm like, of course. And it's free for them. And they can drive to it. The camping was free. Like, and so they just needed a tent. And it's, the camping part is fun too. They get to sit around a campfire and like talk to other students from different schools. And
I mean, every time I think about like sitting around a campfire, it's like our evolutionary, like home. That sounds weird, but like, it's such a long time pattern and custom that like just the idea of sitting around a fire and sharing is, it has connections to all of our ancestors and hominids and everything.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Yeah.
It's really exciting. So what, we talked a little bit about this project that the students are starting, but what are your main, in the next 5 years, let's say, projects that you're working on and topics that you're pushing forward to produce research on and push out new papers?
I see. Yeah. So I'm really excited. We have been trying to get funding to study microchimerism. for a while now, and we finally secured that funding through the Templeton Foundation. So that's going to be a major focus. It's 33 months of funding, and it's go time. It's so wonderful to finally have those resources to dig into these questions. And there's so much to learn about microchimerism. There's so much we don't know because they're rare cells circulating, and I have genetic identical host, right? So it's not like completely different cells. They share half the genome, right? And so trying to find them and figure out what they are has been always a really big challenge. But we have some techniques we're going to use, and we have some really interesting evolutionary questions. We think these cells aren't just byproducts. We think they're maybe important for the host, especially when it comes to the maternal body transferring immune cells to the developing fetus. We could see how that could be beneficial. And the flip side, my lab is going to be studying the fetal cells that migrate into the maternal body.
Okay.
And we also think those have really important purposes as well.
Yeah. And on the like nitty gritty about what's like the size of samples you're getting from Cottage Hospital? Like how many blood samples are you looking at?
So right now we are running a pilot study, and we probably have 150 samples. Okay. We're developing a longitudinal study design, which is really exciting because a lot of these microchimerism studies in the past have been cross-sectional. So it's just one snapshot. We know there's variation. Some people have very little microchimerism, some pregnant people have a lot, and we don't know. And so part of it is, it's like a big, exploratory effort to figure out that variation and start asking why. There's probably a dynamic with the host immune system and these microchimeric cells. So we're going to try and, profile the immune system. But the longitudinal study design will help us with that. And we're going to get about 500 women enrolled and take samples early on in pregnancy and then at labor too. So we're really excited to have two time points.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And hopefully we'll, put more puzzle pieces together. I feel like that's really what it is.
Yeah, it really is. And I work with a big international team on this. And for all of us, microchimerism has always been a side project. Because again, the rare cells are hard to fund, but we're really excited. And like, that was kind of our argument to the funding agency, like, let's make it not a side project. We could really get some traction if someone invested in us, and it could be like the focus of our research for like the next 3 years. Like, let's make it a focus and see if we can do some discoveries. And so we're really excited about that.
Yeah. That's really exciting. And so a lot of the processing happens like in the wet lab. And do you work in the bottom of the bioengineering building for that stuff? Okay. Yeah. It was so funny when I came to your class for EvMed the first day. The last time I'd been in that building was pre-pandemic, however many floors down, doing wet lab stuff. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is what the first floor of this building looks like.
Yeah.
This is what a classroom in here looks like. Cause it's like not the newest because they're building one, but one of the newest buildings on campus. So it's very nice and swanky.
Yeah. We feel very fortunate to have lab space there. It's it's really nice to have a brand new lab and big space to, have trainees come in and be able to work. So
for sure.
Yeah.
Switching topics a little bit, what are some of the lessons, we talked a little bit about the pandemic and when you've taught EvMed in a different size, are there any kind of lessons from online teaching and pandemic life that you're applying to your classes going forward? Because I think there are some takeaways that we learned, in all the craziness.
Yeah. So you mean like, online learning in general, and if I could take anything away.
Even just from pandemic life in general, are there any kind of things that you've applied to your research and or like your classes going forward?
One thing I realized is just making things more accessible over Zoom. Also things that I never thought of before, but every once in a while we get asked in the middle of a quarter, a teaching quarter, to go present at a conference or do these opportunities. And it's always been like, well, no, I'm teaching, that would take too long or something like that. But now it's really becoming more flexible and viable. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, one, I could just record a lecture.
Yeah.
And post it and then go to the conference, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a great option. And the other option is they allow speakers to like Zoom in now,
yeah,
and give their talk. And so I love that accessibility that we're doing, and it's more flexible and being able to work from home sometimes, especially mm-hmm. with two small kids, like being able to like still carry on my day if I have to be home with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important. And it's funny, actually, when you told us that Dr. Joe Alcock was coming in, I automatically assumed he was going to be zooming in on the screen. And then I walked in and I was like, oh my gosh, he's here in person.
Yeah.
I think guest lectures have been something that a lot of my teachers have continued going forward. And it's been something that I'm really thankful for.
I was actually thinking about this. If I could rebuild this class or, you know, pull in more experts, it'd probably be so accessible to ask, you know, someone else to join the class over Zoom and just talk for a day on the specific disease of interest they're interested in. Yeah.
Yeah. That talk that he gave was so fascinating. The whole time I was just sitting there like, whoa, we were learning about the microbiome and visceral mm-hmm. fat being deposited based on bacteria and all that stuff.
Yeah. And I didn't actually know his origin story either, but like, it was so fascinating to hear. Like, so one, he was a UCSB undergrad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was wonderful. And then he went off, and his dad's a behavioral ecologist. He went into grad school studying behavioral ecology, right? And then transitioned to becoming an MD and an ER doc. And I love that because I always assumed it was like he was a med doctor first and mm-hmm. then like dabbled in evolutionary medicine, but no, he was like an evolutionary biologist first and then decided to go to med school. And I think he has such an important and novel perspective on medicine that he's leading the field with. And I think it's just fantastic.
Yeah. And he's a very engaging speaker, I think. And I feel the same way with you. You create lectures that are formatted well. And I know that sounds like the most simple, like basic compliment, but really I've discovered how much easier it is to follow and engage and pay attention and take notes to a lecture that has a real structure to it.
Mm.
And it's really helpful. And I actually should take this time because I followed it. Joe Alcock has also his own podcast. It's called mm-hmm. EvMed, and I'll link it mm-hmm. In this episode because I've been meaning to check it out because I followed him on various things after that talk because mm-hmm. he is really fascinating. So I definitely think that even if he can't come in person for the next time you teach it, maybe ask him to Zoom for that same little like talk or a variation on that talk for the next time you teach it.
Yeah, I agree. I was just so happy to have him come talk, and I think it was beneficial to everyone and having him continue. I'll just bug him a bunch. Maybe he can, he can Zoom in. I'm a poor learner when it comes to like, I think like me building my lectures is based on like how I learn and mm-hmm. how I've had challenges learning in the past. And like, I need visuals. I need like a lot of visuals. And so I put a lot into visuals into the lectures as well, just because I know that's how I need to learn. And so I hope it's useful to others that are more visual learners.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of my favorite things about the UCSB bioanth department right now is something that we were talking about earlier, which is the amount of interdisciplinary research that's going on. Mm-hmm. I think it's really fascinating. And I always like go back to Amy because Amy Anderson is like, mm-hmm. she's been my mama duck since like day one. And she knows this. She's really been such a great guiding force for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she, just because I know her research so intimately, and I feel the same way about you, just these really cool topics that are looking at anthropology from such different lenses that I think is where the field just in general is going. I think it's so cool to see all mm-hmm. this true innovation, people with original ideas that are coming to the plate and just like have the support from, you know, because I know you know this, but people might not know, our bioanth department is like really diverse in the amount of things that people study for a bioanth department. Like it's so much. If you're looking at grad programs, like just go look and like everyone does something different. But within that, we have all these grad students with these really cool research projects. What has it been like for you to mentor these grad students that come in with just like brand new branching ideas? And how does it feel to get to like contribute to that?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you hit on something. That's the reason I took the position here. Like I came and I was like, oh, Santa Barbara. Actually, I interviewed right after it was like after the 2016 election and Trump. And so I came here and I was in a dark place, you know, like it was hard. And I remember interviewing, but I just felt like numb inside really. And I was like, yeah, it's beautiful here, but I don't know. Like, I don't know about this. And then I met the department and I met those grad students and I was like, I want to be a part of this. This seems special. This seems unique. This is unlike any place I've ever been before. They treat each other with, you know, like crazy amounts of respect. They all have these really exciting ideas. And also everyone knows everything about everyone's research, which is, it's really unique. And it's like, we alloparent as, you know, faculty members. Like I help with a lot of grad students that aren't like specifically working under me, and we know so much and about each grad student's projects. And I was like, what a special place. Like, and they told me on this position.
Well, oh gosh, you were here during all the Thomas Fire stuff. Have there been any positive like big things that have happened during your time here? You, I mean, you've been here, gosh, during quite a whirlwind. I'm thinking about the time period that you've been here.
It's crazy. Like we were here for like 6 months and the Thomas Fire hit and the kids were home from school for a month. And I was trying to like navigate this new position and start teaching. And it was so challenging. And then there's the Montecito mudslides. And then just, you know, a year and a half later, it was, you know, COVID. So we haven't really, I don't know. I talked to my family back home and it just seems like California is like, I'm like, it's different living out here. There's just more extremes, the highs and the lows. There's just more extremes and you, you're impacted much more about, you know, global climate change and all that. Like it's impossible to ignore here. And I think that definitely changes like my perception on the culture where, you know, California is, you know, perceived to be more liberal or something like that. And it's like, well, yeah, because like you have to like check your phone at night to see if the winds are high and if there's going to be a fire that, you know, like, especially this week, the winds have been so high.
Oh, I know.
I'm not used to it. Yeah. I still have to be like, are there any fires? Like, and that's just a normal living, for coastal California. And, it's just so different.
My kind of like one of my wrap up questions is for you, like for you is like, what do you like to do on your time off? What do you like to do to decompress and relax and enjoy your time? You know, any hobbies, activities, or maybe it's just sitting with the family.
Well, I love, obviously just spending time, with my kids. They're at such a fun age right now. 10 and 7, it's like that sweet spot. It's just fun. And so I've been coaching my 10-year-old's volleyball team. And so I love doing that. They're so cute and I can't handle it. It's super fun. I also really enjoy, I've gotten really into cycling again. I used to bike a lot in Michigan, but talk about again, differences. Like there's like serious mountains here.
Oh yeah.
The first time I tried to like go up this, it's called Farron here. I had to I almost died, I feel like.
Yeah.
But now I'm getting better at it. But I like to do some pretty long distance cycling right now. And that's a really good way to decompress. And it's like such amazing weather here,
mm-hmm.
except for the wind.
Yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah. It was so funny. I was telling my allergist when I was there, I was like, yeah, well, pretty soon I'm going to be moving to Virginia and there's going to be a whole new environment. So maybe my nose and my allergies will be happier in that one. I don't know. We'll see. Right. Or we'll just have a whole new set of problems.
Yeah, a whole new set of allergies. Who knows? Yeah. Right?
Who knows? Yeah. Who knows? I just know that my dog is going to run in the snow and live her best life. And I'm very excited for her because we actually this morning got a house and she's going to have a yard. So
yay.
Exciting.
Congratulations. I miss the snow. I do. That's the one thing here. I love it here. I'll trade it any day. I actually realized when we moved to the desert, I like the heat.
Oh,
I know. Like, I know.
Good for you.
Like, the summer would come and I'm like, yes. So I do like the heat. But that being said, I miss the snow. And so now in the winters, I'm always trying to get the kids, like, let's go find somewhere where it snowed. Let's go sledding. Sure. Let's like go have some fun in the snow. I miss that.
Yeah. If you haven't considered it yet, something that you have to do with your kids is take them to the islands. The Channel Islands or Catalina. I just went to Catalina for my birthday, because I wanted to do like a getaway without having to worry about serious COVID exposure. And it truly, they are just some of the most magical places ever. There's something so special about the islands and Catalina. You can stay in hotels, but on the other Channel Islands, you can camp, which is really nice.
Yeah, we've been meaning to do that. The boat ride intimidated me at first when I had like a 3-4 year old.
Yeah.
But then COVID hit and so we didn't for do sure. anything for a while, but now she's 7 and we can do it. We can let go camp. And she can not melt down on that boat ride. So we're really excited. We haven't been out there. We just did some whale watching a few months ago. And we got out to the islands and saw a bunch of whales and it was amazing. But it just made me want to book a trip there even more. So
yeah. Yeah. The snorkeling around there and swimming. Oh, it's just, Catalina, the water was crystal clear in Catalina because it's a very, cliffy island, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So there's the water goes from shallow to deep very quickly. So there's not the like equation that waves need to break. So there are just little like swells, but they're like less than a foot. So the water stays like crystal clear and it was just magical. And even though it was very cold, my best friend and I went swimming and people were walking by us like, really? It's 65 degrees and cloudy and you're in the water right now. And we were like, we can't go to Catalina and not go in the water. We're both just like ocean children.
Yeah. Wait, did you go to elementary school around here?
I did.
See Me?
Yeah. I went to See Me. Yeah.
For the audience, can you explain what See Me is? I'm so excited for my daughters to do See Me.
Oh, I'm glad that they get to do it. So it is, so Catalina is mostly protected and there are two sides that you can like go and like actually like stay at. And that the one side that I went to for my birthday just now was Avalon. That's like a mini town. The other side is two harbors and they have kind of these like cabin-y things on the beach. And for my school, I went to Crane Country Day School and we went and we stayed for probably like a week and we did like leadership activities. We did like a zip lining course. We did conservation. You know, we learned about the plants on the island. I think we did some kind of like exercises in conservation and snorkeling and we were learning. You know, I'm trying to remember like specifically what we learned, but it was the 7th grade. It was a while ago, but it was a really cool experience until they wanted us to go snorkeling at night and a shark swam over my foot and I was like, I'm out, guys. And I just sat there in the water crying so much that my mask filled up with tears. And they were like, fine, you go sit on, because now I understand that it was like a swell shark that doesn't bite you.
Yeah.
But I was in the 7th grade. I didn't care. I didn't care.
Yeah. Anyway. I'm still trying to get used to, I don't know. I was surfing at Devro and they have those nurse sharks. Yeah. And I was like, everyone said, oh, they're no problem. They're no problem. They're tiny.
they're about 3 feet long.
The first time I saw her, I was literally in like 6 foot of water, and I was about to get out in the surfboard, and one swam by, and I screamed and jumped on the surfboard like, "Someone help! Sharks!"
Yes.
And everyone looked at me like I was crazy.
It takes some getting used to. It does.
Now we go out there just to watch them swim around and go through our
enough time and you see that they're not coming at you, you're like, okay. It's all right. My favorite thing is to stand on the cliffs, like in September when the water's so clear, because you can see them swimming from the cliffs.
Oh, so cool.
And then it's really pretty because you get kind of a view of like 10 of them, rather than when you're in the water, you kind of have your limited view.
Yeah, you see like one pop up.
They're
so cool though.
Yeah, they are. Well, I have one last little wrap up thing for you. Is there anything that you want to go back on, elaborate on, or any like final questions you have for me before we end this off?
Question for you. What's motivating you? What's your background? What's your next steps? What are you doing?
I'm a bones gal. I love bones. I've always just like, I feel this really weird connection to the human skeleton where I felt like I knew all the bones in the body before I like took my first osteo class. And I took osteo my first year here at UCSB. I was super lucky. Amy Anderson took me under her wing and really helped me get the skills I needed. I was originally interested in forensic anth, and then I switched over more to bioarch because I just personally felt like it was a better fit for me. And I'm really interested in working in like museums and public outreach because the podcast has shown me how much I love teaching. And I could see myself doing like working at a community college and helping kids, you know, find the right track within anthropology.
Yes. Community college. And there's not that much anthropology in community colleges too, right?
Yeah.
It's sometimes rare to have. I don't think I had anthropology in my community college.
So I really want to be like, still, you know, the podcast is not going to last forever. I'm doing it at least through my master's for the next 2 years, but that's what I have kind of set now. I don't think it'll be a forever thing, but continuing to be involved in outreach. And, you know, I had an interview with Sophie Price, who works at a museum in Queensland. And I was really interested in hearing about how they're working to make their museums more accessible for deaf people, for blind people, for people of all disabilities, all, you know, everything, and how important that is. And then also working with Indigenous communities to have them put the descriptions on their like native artifacts. I just thought about how I would really like to shape a museum like that, you know, obviously not the only one, but be a part of creating a space for the public that is educational in the most accessible way. So that's what I'm kind of interested in. I'm going to be at George Mason, which is right next to DC. So I'm really hoping to kind of get started in some museum stuff, hopefully right off the bat, fingers crossed. And I'm working with Dr. Daniel Temple, who does hunter-gatherer populations. And for me, that was a really exciting thing. A lot of the programs I was like focused on was that older, really kind of understudied hunter-gatherers. Yeah. And he works like in Japan, Siberia, Russia. So really at the forefront of migration into the Americas. Cool. So yeah,
Super cool.
So excited. And my like absolute favorite thing is that George Mason is like a big family and they're all super excited. The house that I just not like got, but like rented is with 4 other grad students that are older than me and have different advisors. And they've all been like so sweet. They're so excited to like about the podcast. They're just so kind and have been helpful because obviously, you know, I'm not there in Virginia.
Yeah.
So they've been touring all the places and sending me pictures and just like, it's going to be a really new, exciting adventure.
I love this. I mean, I just had the best, I know a lot of people complain about grad school, but I loved grad school. Like I loved it. It was the most money I'd ever made, even though it still wasn't that much money. Like it was stability.
Yeah.
And I am still best friends with my grad cohort. We just like, I don't know. We just had these connections and it's at a really important time in your life. And we just had a lot of fun. We went through some hardships. It was just like, it's so exciting to hear that you're going to have really like that community.
Yes. And that was my number one thing when I was looking for grad programs was for a really supportive and not competitive environment. So I definitely found that and I'm excited.
Yay. You're going to do great things.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and telling us all about your journey. And we'll all have your lab website and all of some recent publications linked below so people can further look into your research if they're interested.
Awesome. All right.
Yes.
Thank you for having me on.
It was so great.